This is Earth Eats. Welcome. I'm Annie Corrigan.
You know, we'll order a bean, we'll sample it, and we'll think maybe it's going to have a particular personality or go one way. And then it's just always fascinating to put something on the espresso machine and see how it comes out.
Jane Coopersmith roasts the coffee beans. Jeff Grant turns them into lattes and cortados. We'll hear about the partnership behind Hopscotch Coffee. Farmers in Montana are seeing opportunity in a new crop, lentils. We'll put lentils into our chili with Daniel Orr. He also gets festive with some eggnog. And from Harvest, a new chicken processing plant has financial appeal to many Nebraska farmers, but environmentalists are concerned. First, as always, a brief look at food stories from the news with Mark Chilla.
This week, a group of 32 members of Congress called on the FDA to order manufacturers of plant-based drinks to stop calling their products milk. Congressman Peter Welch, a co-author of the letter, points out that the FDA already has a legal definition of milk, and quote, "The FDA regulation defines milk as something that comes from a mammary gland," unquote. As NPR's Dan Charles reports, the letter is the latest round in a long-running battle over the milk label. In 2000, the National Milk Producers Federation filed a formal complaint asking the agency to crack down on the labeling of plant-based drinks as milk. 3 years earlier, the Soy Foods Association of America had asked the FDA to recognize that soy milk is the common and accepted name for a product derived from soybeans and water. So far, the agency has declined to take a stand. A new Duke University study says crowded hog feeding operations magnify flu outbreaks and shift the flu season earlier. Researchers looked at flu data across North Carolina over a four-year period from 2008 to 2012, comparing rates of illness in counties that have concentrated hog farms with those that don't. In two out of the 4 years in the study, flu strains that caused outbreaks had adapted first in pigs before jumping to humans. In those years, flu season started earlier in hog farming counties compared to other areas of the state. And news from a Bloomberg investigation. Antibiotic use in Chinese aquaculture isn't new, and the FDA has known about China's antibiotic problem for over a decade. In 2007, the federal agency implemented an import alert on farm-raised shrimp and other kinds of seafood from China. The products are detained at ports until examined in a laboratory and declared free of antibiotics. But the FDA's import alert and examination only applies to Chinese seafood, not products from other South and Southeastern Asian countries, leaving the door wide open for tainted Chinese seafood to arrive in the U.S. by being rerouted through other countries. In 2011, 75% of contaminated shrimp in the U.S. came from China. By 2015, 77% of contaminated shrimp originated in Malaysia. You can read more about this investigation at eartheats.org.
Mark, working hard over the holidays. Thanks for everything you do.
My pleasure.
Americans eat a lot of meat, and most of it comes from industrial factories that process the animals that end up on our dinner plates. When a new meat plant comes to town, it can mean big business. But as Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports, it could also mean big-time concerns about the environment.
We are standing probably in the middle of the proposed complex.
Randy Rupert and I are standing by an empty cornfield on the south side of Fremont, Nebraska. Looking one way, trucks come and go from the Hormel pork processing plant. About a mile in the other direction, a line of trees hides the wide Platte River. This field is where Costco, the warehouse retailer and grocery store, wants to build a new chicken slaughterhouse, a big one.
The scale is they will process 350,000 chickens a day.
To make sure the plant is humming year-round, Costco wants new farms around Fremont to raise 17 million chickens every year. As of 2012, there were less than a million chickens raised for meat in the whole state. Rupert opposes the project as part of the group Nebraska Communities United. They don't want the truck traffic or smelly chicken barns. They're concerned about unfair farm contracts. And there's the issue of what these chickens will leave behind.
You also have millions of pounds of chicken litter every year that's going to be put on our fields as fertilizer.
Chicken litter is composted manure, feathers, and bedding. Farmers can spread it on fields as fertilizer to help their crops grow. The problem? Nutrients from manure can run off into rivers or leach into groundwater. It's happened before. That's in part how the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland became polluted. Hog manure in Iowa contributes to the high nitrate levels threatening the Des Moines water supply. Rupert says the Costco project takes Nebraska down the same road.
Will one plant bust the bubble? Don't know. But the bubble will bust, as it did in Iowa.
Walt Schaefer is the project manager for Lincoln Premium Poultry, the company leading the Costco project. He says the company will set rules on how farmers can use chicken litter to minimize the impact on the local water supply. Each chicken farm will have to acquire an environmental permit from the state, even though it would not be required by law. Farmers will also have to follow a nutrient management plan.
That is beyond what is required of our producers. But in essence, they'll know how much litter to apply, where to apply it, when to apply it, how to store it, the cover crop that's on the ground, and be substantiated by soil testing.
So now I've moved a couple miles down along the river from where the Costco chicken plant would be. And at this spot, there's a well field that supplies drinking water to the city of Fremont. And if you go another 5 or 10 miles down the river, you'll find wells that supply the cities of Omaha and Lincoln. So if there is more pollution in the Platte, it'll flow right past these wells.
Yes, water quality is dependent to some degree on the water that's flowing directly down the river.
Steve Owen is the water production manager for the city of Lincoln's water system. He's cautiously watching the Costco project, but says the city's wells provide a layer of protection.
We get a lot of natural attenuation or natural treatment, you know, through all of those sand layers that the water flows through.
The sand and gravel act like a filter. That's a big difference from Des Moines, which takes its water straight from the nitrate-heavy Raccoon River. But Alan Kolak, a biologist at the University of Nebraska in Omaha, wonders how much that natural filter can handle. He studies water quality on the Elkhorn River, which also flows near Fremont. He says that river already shows a spike in nitrates and phosphorus when it rains in the spring.
There will certainly be a saturation point of the natural filter to filter out contaminant. And once it supersedes that, then those contaminants can very well wind up in the drinking water supply.
It's up to the water utility to test and treat the local water to ensure it's safe. Kolak says these are the issues that come with raising livestock to feed our hunger for meat in the 21st century. It's just that Costco and the residents of Northeast Nebraska are the next in line to face the question of how to deal with them. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
As a country music singer in Montana, Liz Carlisle says she was interested in the poetry and philosophy of farming and rural life. When she studied the origins of her state's organic movement in grad school, she met the farmers who were moving away from monoculture and growing legumes like lentils and chickpeas. Her research became the book Lentil Underground: Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America. Amy Mayer of Harvest spoke with Carlisle.
Many of my mentors in sustainable agriculture and in agroecology began down that path by starting with the place they were from. It's kind of a tradition in this field to try to understand first how the change could be made in the place where you are quite literally rooted. So I think it made a lot of sense for me, and I think that it definitely helped establish a sense of trust. Even though I was from western Montana, which is very far away in social and geographical feature terms from eastern Montana, I had a commitment to the well-being of that place that went beyond the research project and came before the research project. So I think there was a sense that I had some common goals with the people I was talking to.
How was your story received among sort of Corn Belt farmers and consumers and people who, you know, are seeing constantly corn and soybeans and feel like monoculture has been so pervasive for so long that changing it is, you know, deemed an economic impossibility?
Well, I think, you know, the people who tended to show up for our events definitely skewed towards people who would tell us stories about how they were rotating small grains into their corn and soy, how they were using cover crops, And I've learned in some review research that I did that the incidence of cover crop use has gone up quite dramatically in the Midwest. You know, in the late 80s, just like in Montana, this was a handful of people. Now it's really mainstreamed. You don't have to be a hippie to be an organic farmer, and you don't even have to be an organic farmer to utilize a lot of these organic practices, like cover cropping, which is really dramatic. You know, capturing nitrogen that would otherwise go into the waterways, regenerating the soil, you know, lots of reasons to get excited about that, even on conventional farms. I do have a sense that in the Midwest, the problem is a little bit more challenging because the centrality of industrial agricultural practices to the economy, to the culture, is just stronger because it really is, you know, a center of industrial agricultural production. You know, it is really a rich agricultural zone, and it has been very systematically structured for industrial agriculture. So I think, industrial agriculture would miss Iowa more than they would miss Montana, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
That's probably a good way to put it, yeah. Yeah.
In a pretty big way, but it's harder to move away in Iowa because I do think that the ties are stronger. There's stronger ties to the corporations that actually make money off the food system. Those corporations are in Montana, so there's a very strong populist case to be made that we need to switch to sustainable agriculture if we're going to keep any of the resources from this industry in our own communities. In Iowa and in the Midwest, I think it's more complicated because everybody has a cousin who works for one of these companies that is vilified in the national media these days, you know, in the wake of Michael Pollan's work and concern about the food system. In the Midwest, you know, that's, you know, somebody who earns an income there. So it's a little bit trickier, I think, to talk about transition. And there's, people maybe have a sense that there's more to lose.
Another thing that is strikingly timely is, of course, some of the farmers that you write about really hit terrible economic conditions after drought in the 1980s. And now there's, you know, decades of research to show how the decisions they made transformed their farms. There's a lot right now in USDA projections and therefore all sorts of other media about how low commodity prices are ushering in a new period of reduced income for farmers. Like you just outlined, it's a little bit different for farmers that are more dependent on the major commodity crops versus the smaller commodity crops. And the conditions are different environmentally in the different regions. Do you have any sense of whether a economic situation like the one we're entering now for farmers could again be a catalyst for more of them to make some pretty radical changes on how they use their land?
Yeah. You know, I think low commodity prices always encourage a few farmers, at least, to think about a different option. It also depends on what input prices are doing at the time. You know, if fossil fuel prices were also through the roof right now, the way that happened in the late 80s, that would create a cost price squeeze that I think would actually force a lot of farmers out of industrial agriculture. Our fossil fuel prices are still relatively low compared to what happened in, say, 2008. So it might not be as dire a situation for some farmers as it was in the late 80s, but we certainly do have climate change issues and, you know, tough conditions environmentally. So that piece of the puzzle is in place. And so, yeah, I'm sure there are farmers having conversations right now as we speak about, you know, what are we going to do next year? What do we want to do for the next 5 years? Is there a way for us to get on a more sustainable path that doesn't feel so risky? And I think what I'm trying to encourage in the food movement here is to take this next step to think about grains and legumes and domestic fair trade partnerships with people in the U.S. who grow those crops that are ecologically appropriate in certain areas. And then, of course, also to bridge that to a conversation about international fair trade, which I think people are a little more familiar with. So sustainability is a lot bigger than just this issue of the how many mile radius of your food shed. Totally need to be involved with the farmers and the agriculture around you, but there's good arguments for being involved at a larger scale, too.
Liz Carlisle's book is Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America. She spoke with Amy Mayer. More at harvestpublicmedia.org. Ahead, another drink recipe, as we've been giving you all month. And then Daniel Orr does chili with a few unexpected ingredients. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses. Located on the Beeline Trail, more information at personalfinancialservices.net. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com.
All right, so Eggnog 101. It is rich, but you're only going to have it a couple times a year. So you might as well go out and do the real thing. And so it incorporates a lot of heavy cream, half and half, milk, egg yolks, sugar, all those great things. And we also have today some Harrison bourbon, which is an Indiana bourbon from Brazil, Indiana. So we're going to start. We've got 4 egg yolks and a half cup of sugar and a tablespoon of grated lemon zest. Okay, so we're going to put that in our mixing bowl. All right, and we get this, turn this on. We're just going to whip this until it forms a ribbon. So the egg yolks will get nice and yellow, a very, very kind of sunny color when they whisk with the sugar, and we call that, you know, form a ribbon. So here we go. I would always use really local fresh eggs for this. If you have any suspicion of the eggs being old, don't use them raw, okay? All right, to this we're going to add a little bit of my sweet seasons. You could also use a nutmeg and cinnamon mixture if you'd want. That's about 3/4 teaspoon. Okay, we're going to fold in 1.5 cups of whipped heavy cream.
Now we're getting to the good stuff.
And 4 egg whites that are whipped. And then I'll grab a regular handheld spatula and fold that all together. You can see it's getting that kind of yellow color that you think of when you think about eggnog. But you'll see that it's much lighter. There's a completely different texture to this than the stuff you buy in a jug at the local big box store. Now we're going to add about 3 ounces of this good bourbon. And we're going to add a little bit of milk or half and half, whichever you want. Stir all that in. Okay, we've got to taste it right. And we'll let Gretchen and ML be the taste testers here. There you go.
Thank you.
And we have eggnog mustaches, 2 of them.
Oh, my
Merry
goodness.
Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Thanks to our 2 eggnog tasters. ML is Daniel Orr's mom, and Gretchen Marks was our host for the day. This recipe was originally featured in a big holiday blowout episode, 1 full hour where we cooked duck over an open fire. There was parsnip soup, this eggnog recipe. Listen to it in the archives section of eartheats.org, and then subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss a single episode. We like to look at the relationships behind our food. Starts with a farmer, maybe goes to a chef, then to your plate. In coffee, you can add a couple more links to that chain, farmer to roaster to barista to customer. It's the partnership in the middle that we're interested in today. Jane Coopersmith started roasting coffee beans in her house in ultra-small batches, like we're talking 1 bag at a time. Jeff Grant has worked as a barista in several shops over the years. Their coffee worlds collided, at first reluctantly, 2 years ago when they opened Hopscotch, a coffee shop with an in-house roastery. As they describe it, their best coffee is always the result of collaboration.
I needed a partner because I knew I was really interested in the cafe part of coffee.
Right.
Not just the roasting part. But I also knew I didn't have that expertise, and I didn't. There aren't enough hours in the day for a person to wear all those hats.
Definitely not. The idea of a partner had never really crossed my mind, so I was trying to see into the future as much as I could. And
what's funny
guess
about
how that was going to go
is that everybody kept saying, "Don't get a partner. Like whatever right. you do, don't get a partner.
Yeah.
Then you're stuck together, and then it's like, you know, you're with those people for life."
Right. I'm sure it could be very hard. I've seen it go the wrong way before. You know, people get in business together and then they don't speak to each other anymore sometimes. Definitely didn't want that. I was just trying to imagine if I had tried to start a coffee shop and was getting beans roasted from another state or something. I was just imagining them like showing up in the mail, and I was imagining trying to ask the roaster questions about a bean and not being able to. And it just kind of made me think about how valuable that is, where I'm like, hey, what's up with this coffee bean you roasted this morning? When we were trying to make the cold brew, it's pretty typical for people that make cold brew to like make a blend and kind of get the best quality of each bean. And we ordered a Bolivian bean and roasted it fairly light, and it was just, I just thought it was perfect. I was like, right out of the gate, it was like, yeah, that's the cold brew bean. Like,
we
problem
both felt
solved.
That way.
Yeah.
Like, it's one of our favorite beans. We think it's really special. You get the tasting notes when you drink the cold brew. The tasting notes are like milk chocolate with caramel sweetness and lemon acidity and a little bit of almond. And you taste that, especially the almond and the lemon. It's really amazing. It's so clean and bright. You know, we'll order a bean, we'll sample it, and we'll think maybe it's going to have a particular personality or go one way. And then it's just always fascinating to put something on the espresso machine and see how it comes out.
Mm-hmm. What's the one that I'm blanking on it?
I think that like Humbella.
Yeah.
We were trying it as our single origin espresso. It's a single farm Ethiopian, which is really rare. The Ethiopian coffee commodity system operates sort of like in the Midwest. I use the analogy of the grain elevator. There's all these small farmers that take their coffee beans to what's called the washing station, but it's sort of the equivalent of the local grain elevator. So then you'll get your coffee from a particular region in Ethiopia, but it'll basically be like all the tiny farmers in that area. So there's a lot of variation in the beans. But anyway, this Humbella is from a single farm. And so what that means is that it's way more consistent, high quality picking of a single varietal in a single location, processed at a single place. So it's, I feel like that natural Humbella has been my number one fave of anything that we've had.
Yeah, me too, probably.
Yeah. So we tried it on the espresso machine and we're pretty into it. And I don't know what made us decide. We had already been letting it rest like 4 or 5 days. And we decided to let it go 2 weeks before we put it in the espresso machine. It was just mind-blowing.
Yeah, like how long the bean rests after it's been roasted. And that's something we've played with. Like, I think Jane is better at seeing a bean's potential. Like, I'll try something and be like, oh, this isn't working. I've tried it. I've done everything I can do, you know. And I think you're better at realizing, oh, I think, like, it tastes like it needs to rest longer. That's something I'm not as good at identifying as you are.
Granted, I can be a nuisance sometimes too. Things aren't ready as soon as Jeff needs them, and that's really obnoxious. But
well, if we want to get into the
that
downside.
Side of things.
Jeff Grant and Jane Coopersmith of Hopscotch Coffee in Bloomington, Indiana. We've posted pictures along with the audio of this story at eartheats.org. Special shout out to audio engineer Casey Zakin for her help with this story.
A small latte. That's it.
Now, this recipe is not your typical chili recipe. You'll hear Daniel adding some unusual ingredients, including a cup of the undrunk coffee that's been sitting in the pot all day.
All right.
But he starts with the bison. This is a good recipe to start with if you've never cooked bison yourself. It's a leaner meat than beef, and it cooks quickly. So you want to keep an eye on it in this step one as you get a good sear on it.
All right, so just a little bit of olive oil. You could use any type of fat that you like. We're going to add the bison, and you can see the bison's a real rich, dark, almost burgundy-looking meat. It's very, very lean. Just going to break that up. Okay, and we're going to just start adding the other ingredients. It's a really simple recipe. It's just about tossing all this stuff in. And this is going to be a bison, pumpkin, and lentil chili. So we're going to have some different flavors in there that you might not expect. We're going to add our red and green peppers. We've got some diced carrots, a couple cups of fresh diced tomatoes, lots of onions. You can't have too many onions in a chili. Probably got about 4 cups there. We've got 1/4 cup of sorghum. Now, sorghum is a type of molasses that we use. It comes from a grain that's kind of close to a corn, and it's going to add a sweetness. What they do is they reduce the pressed juice of the sorghum cane until it gets a nice, rich amber color. I'm going to toss all this together. Okay, and now we're going to add our seasonings. Got some ground cumin, some cayenne pepper, which is going to give it a little bit of a bite. Got a little bit of onion or garlic powder just to kick that flavor up. We've got some au poivre, which is my 5-pepper blend, and a little bit of cinnamon. Okay, and we just got a couple more ingredients. This is where the Columbus Cowboy comes in. This is the some old coffee. So when you have leftover coffee, don't throw it away. What I like to do is to use it in chilies and stews.
Oh, and here comes the pumpkin.
Here comes the pumpkin. And what this is going to do is add a touch of sweetness. And the last ingredient is the lentils. We're just going to top this off with enough water to moisten it all up. Okay, so we're going to let this come to a full boil, reduce the temperature to a simmer, and then let it simmer for about a half an hour or until it gets nice and thick and chili-like.
Find the recipe on our website. We've also posted several cookie recipes, from pumpkin spice snickerdoodles to coffee cardamom cookies. There's even one that includes miso, our little holiday gift to you at eartheats.org. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb. Taste matters. Your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. A very happy holiday season to you and yours from all of us here at Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.